Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to this edition of our English feature program. I'm Philippa Hitchin. Coming up today, as the Church marks the 40th anniversary of Pope Paul VI's great social encyclical, Populorum Progressio, we take a look at its relevance to those working for peace and justice around the world today. And as Britain remembers the horrors it helped to perpetrate through the transatlantic slave trade, the Anglican Archbishop of Canterbury tells us why people of faith must continue to fight against slavery in modern society. Welcome to the programme. Church leaders in the United Kingdom this past weekend led commemorations marking the 200th anniversary of the abolition of slavery in Britain, an event that has been marked across Africa and the Caribbean as well. March 25th was the bicentenary of the Act of Parliament which officially banned the slave trade across the former British Empire, a trade that is believed to have involved up to 25 million African men, women and children. In London, the Anglican Archbishops of Canterbury and York joined African government officials, leaders of other churches and thousands of ordinary people in an open-air commemoration focused around the themes remembrance, repentance and restoration. Music and drama accompanied the crowds as they reflected on the horrors of slavery and its legacy around the world today. Symbolic acts of witness included a group of people who had worn yokes and chains during a 250-mile walk from Hull in the north of England to London, being unshackled and released by the Archbishop of the West Indies. Down by the Thames, the church leaders said prayers as a wreath was sent downriver, marked with the number 2,704, the same number of ships which set sail carrying African slaves across the Atlantic to work in the British sugar plantations. Several million of them died on the journey across the ocean. Of those who did survive, an estimated one in three died of hunger, disease or ill treatment within 3 years of their arrival in the Caribbean. But 200 years on, just how much can a public commemoration of this kind hope to heal memories and inspire those fighting against injustice in today's world? Questions I put to the Archbishop of Canterbury, Dr. Rowan Williams, on the eve of these anniversary events.
I think it'll be good for us to be reminded of two things to start with. One is quite simply the fact that part of this nation's history is the shameful episode of our involvement, our active involvement in the slave trade. And the other thing, of course, the other side of that, is the amazing moral courage of a group of people who finally persuaded this country to change its policy. And I think that's something which sends out a very good message about what can be achieved by determined political witness by Christians. But I hope also that it'll focus attention on the forms of slavery that still exist in the world, sex trafficking, child labour and so on, and really renew people's commitment to do something about those.
As you say, you'll be remembering people like William Wilberforce, whose faith led him to spearhead this campaign to end slavery. But there were also, as you say, many people also within the church who profited from this terrible trade in human beings. Has this been recognised enough, do you think?
I don't quite know what enough would feel like. It's certainly been recognised, and we continue to keep it before people's minds. The Synod of the Church of England passed a resolution acknowledging this, and there will be very clear elements of repentance and acknowledgement of past sin in the worship over the weekend.
This is an ecumenical initiative, isn't it? Many different churches and religious organisations in Britain taking part in this. But would you say that the Church of England bears a particular responsibility because of its role as the established church?
Undoubtedly, the Church of England has a very particular level of involvement in that history. The Society of the Propagation of the Gospel, of which the Archbishop of Canterbury was president, was, of course, a slave-owning body. It owned two plantations in Barbados. And looking at the minutes of their meetings is not a very edifying experience. So, yes, we do have to put our hands up and say the national church of this country was heavily involved in this, and so that's why both archbishops are there to acknowledge this.
As you say, there was an official apology issued by the Church of England last year. Do you see this as the beginning of a process of reflection?
I think inevitably we'll go on thinking about what the implications are of acknowledging our complicity. And it does put a challenge to us about how we continue to deal with the legacy of slavery, which is still around in the world, the legacy of that huge trauma inflicted on Africa in the 16th, 17th and 18th centuries especially. And yes, it concentrates our minds, I think, a good deal on what we ought to be doing about that now.
I'm gonna tell God all my troubles when I get home. I'm gonna tell God all my troubles when I get home.
As you say, you're talking about these legacies of that slave trade, but how much do you actually think that the modern-day problems of racism or trafficking or oppression can be directly blamed on this past history?
I don't know how far they can be directly blamed. The point is really that they're analogous to that past and that some things have been allowed to grow up and go almost unnoticed and unchallenged, just as the slave trade was. So we're really asking people to open their eyes to those current things that are, in their own way, just as much an offence to human dignity and human liberty, and to say, keep noticing these things, keep asking what can be done for.
There are many different parts of this commemoration. Can you tell us a bit about, for example, the national service that's going to be held in Westminster Abbey? I understand that Cardinal Cormac Murphy O'Connor will be taking part in that.
That's very much an attempt to find a voice for not just the churches but the whole nation, as is appropriate in Westminster Abbey. And to do that not just in a context where we're, you know, like making ourselves feel guilty, because that's not the point. It's just an acknowledgement that this is our history and it's still a challenge before us. So it's, I think, an effort on Tuesday to try and make sure that people do raise in their own minds the awareness of that history. Do ask those questions about the future, not just as believers, but simply as people in this country who have that legacy to live with and confront.
During your recent visit to Tanzania, you went to Zanzibar and saw the actual slave pits and the chains, didn't you, where people were held before they were shipped over to Britain. That made an enormous impression on you, didn't it? Can you tell us a bit about that?
I think when you see the actual, what you might call the technology of inhumanity, close up like that, it's particularly shocking. You think all sorts of people, not completely unlike you and me, would be involved in this, would be involved in shackling women and children, in pushing them into a space the size of a bathroom in their 50s and 75s, crowded on top of each other, knowing nothing of what was going on, terrified out of their minds. And you think, what is it that makes people think that's normal? I think that was the most frightening thing about it. That and the sense of the mental torment that people must have gone through, not knowing what the future was. People who've been captured, taken to a place where nobody spoke their language, passed from hand to hand, beaten, brutalised, raped, with no notion of what's going on. And that particular element of sheer mental torture, I think, hadn't quite registered on me as forcibly as it did then when I stood in those little rooms.
There's an Anglican cathedral, isn't there, now built on top of that old slave
yes,
market?
Yes, the Anglican mission in Zanzibar played a very significant part in combating slavery in its last days in East Africa in the late 19th century. And you might almost say it's a kind of attempt to make reparation for the involvement of the Anglican Church in other parts of the world earlier. So when the cathedral was built, it was a very deliberate decision to build it on the site of the slave market, and where the old flogging post had been, in front of the high altar of the new cathedral, there's a small circle of red marble to remind everybody that that's what was there, that's what happened.
You've also just returned from a visit to Angola and South Africa, haven't you, to talk about the church's vital role today in trying to help combat problems of poverty to achieve these Millennium Development Goals.
That's right.
Were you encouraged by what you saw there, or perhaps overwhelmed by the huge problems that these countries still face?
It's difficult not to be overwhelmed. But I think when you see that even the smallest difference can be made by small dedicated groups, you realise that is such a lot better than nothing. The small project we visited just outside Luanda in Angola, where we saw work that was being done by the Congregational Church, the Anglican Church and Christian Aid in partnership, simply teaching simple handicrafts to local women so that they could sell their goods and providing creche facilities and some education for their children. A very small thing, but it's not too difficult to multiply, in fact, with a little bit of extra resourcing from outside. These small-scale, what you might call low-intensity, low-budget enterprises can be delivered all over the place without a huge bureaucracy. And I think that's the great strength of the church in these settings. They can deliver measurable goals without a big bureaucracy. That's, I think, what government and NGOs need to learn to work better with.
And my thanks there to Dr. Rowan Williams, Archbishop of Canterbury and leader of the Worldwide Anglican Communion. The progressive development of peoples is an object of deep interest and concern to the Church. This is particularly true in the case of those peoples who are trying to escape the ravages of hunger, poverty, endemic disease, and ignorance. The hungry nations of the world cry out to the peoples blessed with abundance. And the Church, cut to the quick by this cry, asks each and every man to hear his brother's plea and answer it lovingly. So began Pope Paul VI's prophetic encyclical, Populorum Progressio, or On the Development of Peoples, published 40 years ago at Easter 1967. The document was partly the result of the Pope's own travels, a revolutionary idea back then, to Latin America, Africa, India, and the Holy Land. There he saw with his own eyes the grinding poverty, sickness and desperation that contrasted so sharply with the economic progress and fast-growing consumer culture of Western countries. There he saw the urgent need for the Christian message of love, compassion, justice and equality to act as a social conscience and to speak out against the growing gap between rich and poor.
I think that whole sense of a social conscience is really important, and it's really important that churches and faith leaders can speak out on these issues, especially speaking out from the perspective of people who are poorest and marginalised.
Christine Allen is director of the London-based international development charity Progressio, which draws its inspiration from Pope Paul's visionary encyclical. Though it was founded during the Second World War in response to the rise of fascism in Europe, the organisation today focuses on projects with partners across the developing world.
In the 1960s in particular, we developed a very much kind of Africa focus, replacing people to work with local organisations and churches. And that developed into a very professional international volunteering placement. So now we place more than 80 development workers, we don't call them volunteers, to do training, skills development, capacity building with overseas partners in 11 different countries around the world, including mainly Latin America, but Africa and the Middle East as well.
If you look closely at the document Populorum Progressio, Pope Paul VI talks about his own journeys, his own experiences of seeing people in Latin America, Africa, India and the Middle East as part of his inspiration for that document. Do you think it would have been possible for him without this first-hand experience to write that kind of encyclical?
Well, personal contact is very important, and I think we have to remember 40 years ago, the world was quite different in terms of technologies, in terms of people's awareness of what was going on in the world. Today, you know, through the click of a computer screen, we can see, we can be engaged with realities, you know, around the world. And so it is a much quicker and a much more engaging sort of spread of information. Clearly, in 1967, that wasn't the issue. You know, people, the flow of information was much slower, and there wasn't that sort of sense of engagement. But at the same time, it comes out very clearly in the document how much the Pope had been moved by his experiences. And we know from our experiences of development workers and our own travel meeting partners that that kind of personal contact is just invaluable. It's immeasurable almost. But at the same time, you know, you don't have to travel around the world to be able to have that kind of contact. And at the end of the day, I think it's about an empathy. It's about a sympathy. It's about a sense of solidarity that's deep within your being, which is quite a gospel sort of thing in the way that Jesus was moved to tears on those sorts of occasions. And so I think, yes, it's very clear that the Pope's real hand experience clearly had an impact, but also I think there was an openness there to being in touch with people and to feeling that common humanity, which perhaps we can find other ways of accessing in today's world.
The Pope also draws on social encyclicals written by his predecessors, doesn't he? But what do you think are perhaps the most innovative parts of Populorum Progressio? Why would you say perhaps it has still such a relevance for us today?
Catholic social teaching is always quite contextual, so what's written in 1967 isn't always relevant 40 years later. But I think one of the interesting things about Populorum Progressio is just actually how relevant and how challenging it still is. And for those people that know about Catholic social teaching, in some respects the radical nature of church teaching isn't a surprise. But if you haven't come across Catholic social teaching before, which I hate to say, rather too many Catholics haven't, but if you haven't, I mean, reading that document, it's incredibly radical. It's incredibly challenging. I mean, the fact that it talks about a structural analysis to poverty. It talks about a full vision of development, one that includes peace, one that includes cultural self-determination, one that talks about choices, one that talks about people being able to control their own destinies. It's talking about this concept of full humanism, which is about saying everybody should strive to that. You know, Catholics don't have a monopoly. Everybody strives towards that full humanism. And this openness to working with others, I think, is incredibly challenging. Here in the UK at the moment, we're debating about Trident. And, you know, there's an ironic kind of passage in there that actually talks about the Pope seeking a world fund, which will be funded by reductions in military spending. You know, the kind of challenges and debates that are extremely radical. It's no wonder the Catholic social teaching is the Church's best-kept secret.
As you say, it contains very many visionary ideas regarding development, regarding even issues like trade justice. And if we look at the movement for fair trade, which has suddenly become very popular and very widespread, but why did it take so long, I suppose the question is, for these ideas to take root?
Well, I think the answer to why it takes so long is linked into what we've just been discussing, which is the radical nature of it. It's an incredibly radical challenge. You know, it's very clear in this document about, you know, a new conscience of our times, you know, that very sense of asking people to think radically and differently about your life. Now, I mean, in some respects, we're probably more aware of poverty and injustice in today's society than perhaps people were in 1967. So, you know, it was going to be even more radical in those times. So I think there is something about, yes, it was ahead of its time. Catholic social teaching has always been a little bit ahead of its time. I mean, Pope Leo XIII in 1891 was talking about the rights of workers when the labour movement was effectively in its infancy. Popolo and Progresso doesn't just talk about right trading relationships. He also talks about debts. He talks about reductions in military expenditure and the relationship between development and peace, issues that we're still struggling with, you know, and issues about when you do engage in development partnerships, that you do it with, there's a lovely phrase that when it talks about kind of how people engage with the development process, that they go to serve and to collaborate, not as masters. When experts come with expertise, they must season it with love, you know, and recognizing the challenges that very often that missionary organizations and churches perhaps hadn't always operated in that way, but that's the way in which we should do it.
Across the world, Catholic development agencies are marking the anniversary of Popolorum Progressio, stressing the need to put into practice the principles outlined so clearly by Pope Paul VI.
Perhaps this is an occasion to remind as many people as possible that this document existed and it was meant to challenge us to social action, social justice.
Archbishop Ignatius Kaigama heads the Diocese of Jos in northern Nigeria. He's working closely with CAFOD, the Agency for Overseas Development of the Catholic Church in England and Wales, to promote their Live Simply campaign, highlighting the way each one of us can do something to further those goals of justice, equality and peace.
It's meant to be a reminder to wealthier nations to be conscious of the needs of others who are not equally blessed materially, the need for mutual solidarity, for social justice and universal charity. So we continue to tell people as individuals to live simply, then this will extend to the families, to the schools and perhaps to government. And when we begin to be conscious of the needs of others and we try to bridge the gap between the rich and the poor, I think the world would be certainly a better place. There will be less crisis, there will be less violence, and we will all be happy and living together as God's children.
Certainly there is a much greater awareness today, isn't there, about the needs of the continent of Africa. There are many projects, many government goals have been set up to try and to deliver the kind of aid that will help African countries get back on their feet again. And yet somehow this awareness, it seems, doesn't always translate into a real improvement in the lives of people in those countries.
Yeah, a lot is said to be given by foreign governments and international agencies for the alleviation of poverty in Africa. But I'm afraid to say that sometimes these funds are just given without taking care to monitor what the funds are being used for. Every country will quote that in their effort to alleviate poverty, they have given so many million pounds, so many million dollars for this and that. But I want to say there is no adequate monitoring to ensure that these resources are used for the purposes intended. Sometimes this money gets lost among political leaders. And therefore, there is need to do proper follow-up and close monitoring. And if it were possible to channel these funds to agencies that are faith-based, whether they are Christian or Muslim or whatever, it will help a lot. I have benefited immensely from the contributions of CAFOD in the area of primary health care, HIV/AIDS, area of water supply and so on in my archdiocese. And I think if such huge funds were channeled to agencies that would give them out and ensure proper monitoring and get things going, we will go a long way in alleviating poverty. But the funds get lost in government circles, sometimes through corruption and sometimes through reckless use of these funds.
Is corruption still a very big problem there in your native Nigeria?
Definitely, corruption is a problem, and we are trying our best to ensure it's a thing of the past. The President Obasanjo has instituted social reform programs to do away with corruption. It's not an easy battle, but the fact is that it has started and there is a spreading consciousness that corruption is evil, is criminal. And I think by God's grace, we hope to develop a culture where people are able to consider the common good and work selflessly towards ensuring common good for all.
Give us an idea of the situation in your own diocese. How serious is the problem of poverty there, the problems of water, the things that you're talking about?
Yes, as a pastor, I go around faithfully every weekend to villages where I spend 2 days or so at the weekends, and I see what other politicians would not see because they don't go there anyway in the first place. I stay with the people. I know the kind of water they drink. Sometimes the water you see, you will not even like to wash your hands with, but that is all they get, they have, and that is all they use. And when I visit, like during pastoral work, rather than focus on spiritual matters, people are bringing their social needs. We have no water, we have no school, that child is dying of this and that, and you become like a social worker. And this is what we do. In my office, when I am in office attending to official matters, I have long queues waiting to see me. And what are they looking for? Not simply prayers or counseling. They are looking for basic needs. Water, they are looking for money to buy medicine for that child who is dying, or they want blood transfusion, they don't have the money. And this is all you get. So as a pastor, I see that my people are suffering, and there is a lot that government could do to alleviate this. And I hope we shall be working in partnership with government, and if they listen at all, we will do something together to alleviate poverty.
Christine, the aims of organisations like your own are reflected in the Millennium Development Goals, aren't they? That ambitious list of targets we're trying to reach by the year 2015. Are you still optimistic that we are heading in the right direction?
I am hopeful that some of the goals can be achieved. I mean, they were a very ambitious target, but, you know, ambition is no bad thing. I think the major threat to our world is mediocrity and apathy, not ambition. And in terms of tackling poverty and injustice, we should always strive to be ambitious. And I think there's a lot that churches and faith groups and faith leaders can contribute to that process too. There's a lot that can be done, and there's a lot that is being done. A lot of provision of services is very positive, is very good. And in the same way that Paul VI talked about our recognition of the new social conscience for all, I think the Millennium Development Goals in some respects help to provide something like that new social conscience, both from the Millennium but also from the global call to end poverty in the UK. It was called Make Poverty History. Those sorts of campaigns that are really focused around holding governments to account to make sure that they meet their Millennium Development Goals targets are, I think, in many respects, new social consciences and should be supported by everybody.
And my thanks there to Christine Allen, director of the London-based international development charity Progressio, and to Archbishop Ignatius Ayau Kaigama of the Diocese of Jos in Nigeria. And that's all from me, Philippa Hitchin, and from all of us here at the English Programme for today. We'll be back on the air at this same time tomorrow. Be sure to join us then if you can. In the meantime, don't forget you can always find all our news and feature programmes on the internet. Just look us up at www.vaticanradio.org/English. Listening to Vatican Radio. Laudato Jesus Christus.